The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
And now I'm delighted to welcome to the show Jarvis Cocker. How are you, Jarvis?
I'm very well, Brendan. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Now, Jarvis, people will know you, obviously, as a pop star, as the frontman of Pulp, among many other things. But you've written a book now, and it's not quite a celebrity memoir, but it kind of is. Can you explain Good Pop, Bad Pop to the listeners?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I suppose the basic concept of it is that there was a house in London that I used to live in, and I stored a lot of stuff in the loft of this house. Then I moved away from London, came back about 20 years later. In between times, I've been thinking, you know, one day I'll get round to clearing that place out. Finally, I got to clearing it out. And what I decided, which I'm glad about now, because this is what the book is based on, is that instead of just chucking it all in a skip, I decided to look at every object, take photos, try and remember why they were there. And as time went on, I realised that it was telling me a story which turned out to be my own life story.
Mm. There's a touch of Marie Kondo there, isn't there?
There is. She's a big influence. There's also, you know, it's a weird thing. The day after I'd finished clearing the loft out, I was listening to the radio. I was listening to the BBC, obviously, and there was a thing on Radio 4, I think it was on Woman's Hour, and they said, and we'll sit in a minute, we'll be talking to blah, 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 the author of the book, Swedish Death Cleaning. And I thought, I must have misheard that. But then that was a similar thing. This was this woman in, unfortunately I've forgotten her name, but this woman in Sweden who had basically written a book about clearing her loft out, and the whole premise of it was that you would do it so that your kids didn't have to do it after you died.
Okay.
Sorry, that's a spoiler. I've spoiled that book for anybody who might have thought of reading it.
Did you feel liberated after you'd cleaned out the loft? Did you feel ready for death, maybe?
I said, come and take me now. Take me now.
I've done my work on this earth.
No, I didn't quite think that. But I did feel better because I think all of us have probably got like a cupboard or a shed or something where you just chuck stuff without thinking about it, thinking, oh, I'll get round to sorting that out at another time. And we very seldom do that. I did. And I found something interesting about it, you know, because mm-hmm. I'd been approached times in the past, people saying, you know, are you going to get round to writing a memoir or an autobiography one day? And it never really appealed to me. But coming at it from this slightly different angle where it was like the objects told me a story that I would never have remembered. You know, some of these things, like, I mean, there's one thing in the book, like this exercise book that I wrote in when I was about 15.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a minute, maybe, because I think that is the key to everything, really. In terms of this project, though, I want to say a lot of people who had a book in them kind of got it out in lockdown. It sounds like a bit of a lockdown affair doing this. Was it a lockdown project for you?
I did some of it, but I'd started a good 2 years before. I'm just very slow, as I write about that a little bit in the book. But for sure, I think that time in lockdown, I guess a lot of people had that thing where you just thought it's now or never. You know, there's no excuse not to do it because, you know, we can always invent an excuse. But in lockdown, it was just pretty obvious that if there was something you'd been putting off, now was the time to grapple with it, basically.
Yeah. I'm a bit concerned about you in the sense that I think a lot of people are trying to move on from COVID and everything. But when you were on the line earlier, you were sanitizing your hands, I noticed. And it struck me that maybe, have you become quite neurotic about COVID? Are you having difficulty in moving on?
I'm not really, to be honest. But I suppose the thing is, like, I still haven't had it. I mean, that's the thing that I can't believe.
Yeah.
So, like, my partner's had it. Most people I know have had it, but for some reason, like, for instance, you know, like we went and did a tour just before Christmas. I thought I'm bound to get it now. We played Butlins. We played Butlins. Honestly, we did Butlins, Bognor Regis, you know, the pinnacle of my live performance career. We played a festival there in January, like the height of Omicron. I thought, you know, it was indoors. It had a low ceiling. I just thought, this is it. How do you avoid getting it? Just haven't got it.
Right. And you were always a kind of a poorly kind of person, weren't you? You'd be the kind of person to get colds and flus and that kind of thing.
I have been. But I'm, and it's nice of you to point it out. But but I'm a bit more sturdy now.
Okay, good, good. So listen, a lot of the what we might call the subjects of the book, the items that you pick through to tell your story, they are what some people might describe as junk or rubbish.
Yeah, I would describe them as that.
Okay, but they're important then.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that kind of spurred me on to write, I suppose, that thinking, why have I kept hold of this junk? Because some of it was stuff that I brought down. You know, when I moved from Sheffield to London in the late 80s, I brought a lot of stuff with me. And I never questioned it. I just thought, I have to have that stuff around me. And some of it, you know, as you kindly point out, is garbage. You know, there's like bits of soap. You know, things like that. But for some reason, as I say, I never questioned it. I just thought, I have to have these things with me. So that was part of the reason for writing it, I suppose, for trying to work out why I'm like that.
Yeah. There are other clues to you in it too, in terms of there are photos. And the photos of your childhood, there are a few photos of your childhood. It's very clear you grew up surrounded by women, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I mean, that was a thing that my dad left when I was just 7. And it seemed like he'd come up with the idea of it with his mates in the pub because they all left their wives as well. So my uncle Bob also disappeared and my uncle David also disappeared as well. So... And then my mum's brother, which was the only other kind of youngish guy around in the family circle, had a terrible accident and died. So suddenly the only male around was my granddad. And those photographs that you mentioned were taken by my grandfather. But nobody knew they existed, actually. It's weird. I only discovered those after both Ian and my grandma had passed away.
That was an eventful evening in the pub, wasn't it? When I wonder who broached it first. Like, hey, lads, will we all leave our wives? The first person to say it is the brave one there, aren't they? Bizarre.
I guess, yeah. I mean, that's another thing I found from writing a book is that you may have got what you think is a memory or you know what's house event. But once you start investigating the past, it gets very slippery and unusual, and often the story that you've told yourself maybe for your whole life and ends up being not true.
Yeah, for example, explain about your eyesight and what you thought.
Yeah, that's a good example. I mean, you know, so I had a condition called meningitis when I was younger. It's like a viral thing. It can be quite serious if it's not treated promptly, but I it was treated promptly with me, so I didn't die or anything. But one of the common side effects is it messes your eyesight up. I think I read once that, like, John Lydon, you know, of the Sex Pistols, that's what did his eyesight in. So I just assumed that was why I've got such terrible eyesight, and I'd kind of, you know, trotted this story out, very heart-rending story, to people over the years. And then I was with my mum a few years ago talking, maybe, I don't know, we were just talking about this and that. And then she said, what are you talking about? That's not why you wear glasses. You wore glasses pretty much as soon as you went to school. So she said, you know, you went to school, the teacher realised you couldn't see anything on the blackboard. They moved you to the front row. You still couldn't see anything. So we took you for some glasses. So I thought about that for a minute and I thought, hold on, mum. So what you're saying to me basically is that I was virtually blind for the first 5 years of my life, but nobody noticed. And I just couldn't really, you know, she looked a bit sheepish then. Like, I must have been good at disguising it, I don't know. But so that made me think, you know, like, what is it to live in fog for the first 5 years of your life? Discuss.
And the discussion you have in the book brings us back around to the junk, really, doesn't it? Because is you think maybe that is the root of you holding on to all these little details of life, because maybe that's all you could see. You looked at things up close and just saw detail.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's it. I mean, obviously, that's me kind of playing at being the cod psychologist now. I've no way of really working out, because, I mean, all of us, we have very, very misty memories, don't we, of that, like, first 5 years of life. I mean, you might remember one or two things, but it's really, I think it's a really interesting part of any human being's life, that developmental bit where, obviously, you're growing physically and your mind's growing and you learn about the world, but you have absolutely no recall of it when you're older.
Yeah, no, speaking of development, but kind of later development, I suppose, one of the consequences of your father not being around was that you kind of had to try and give yourself a sex education, which you do document in the book. And it does really show up how different things were then to now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I kind of held on to as maybe some kind of something that could give me an insight into sex, I suppose mainly from a male perspective, because I did used to eavesdrop on my mum and her friends. I used to kind of listen outside the kitchen door and hear what they were saying about the men in their life, you know, which was an eventful thing. Seeing as all the husbands had left at once, they were all dating again. So, you know, I would hear how they were getting on with the various paramours. But I just wanted to know what men thought about sex, you know. So one day we'd gone swimming with the school and then we got on the bus to go back to school and there was this fantastic dirty joke book thing on the back seat of the bus and there was a massive fight, as you can imagine, between teenage boys to see who could get it. And somehow I managed to get it and take it home. And I thought, oh, here we go. I'll find out a bit about what it's all about now. But in the end, it just confused me more because I was reading these jokes and I just didn't understand them at all. So I just thought, oh, if I don't understand the jokes, that means I just don't know anything about sex. If anything, it just clouded the issue even further.
Mm. Did you fit in as a kid?
Not really, no. I mean, I think my mum was a bit bohemian. I think probably my dad too, though I have kind of vague memories of him, but so I had long hair when that really wasn't a thing, especially in the suburbs of Sheffield. And my mum had interesting kind of idea of what would be suitable clothing to go to school in. So, you know, she would put me in these weird, like, very tight ribbed polo neck jumpers. Once, you know, a relative sent over these lederhosen and I had to go to school in them, and that caused a lot of hilarity amongst the other kids, you know, and stuff like that. So I was kind of shy. Maybe that was something to do with the eyesight thing. I was the oldest kid in our family, you see, so I'd never really had other kids to play with so much. So going to school, there wasn't a nursery, so that was the first time I'd really mixed with a lot of other kids. So, yeah, I was a bit awkward.
Mm. So then we come to the copybook, which it's kind of uncanny because it's not totally inaccurate in how it played out. But you had written down at the age of what, 15, Jarvis, your master plan for world domination with a band called Pulp.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that as I say, that was one of the things that convinced me that it was worth going through the stuff in the loft, you know, and sifting through it, because there could be other things like that, because I'd forgotten about this book. I mean, it obviously had meant something to me at the time, because, like, for a start, my handwriting is legible, so, and I'd done proper joined up writing, so I obviously was thinking, this is important, I have to take time over this. And basically it was me kind of doing a kind of what nowadays you would call positive visualization of my future career as a pop star. So I thought, you know, the group's going to get it starts with a guide to what the group is going to wear. There's this guide to the Pulp wardrobe where all the members of the band are going to wear duffel coats and CNA crew neck jumpers. And I mean, we would be so hot on stage just with those two items of clothing there. You would be kind of dying after one song if you went on stage with a duffel coat on. So, and then I'd move on to this master plan of we're going to get famous. Then when we're famous, we're going to set up our own record company and release records by other artists, freeing them from the grip of the major record companies. And then we'll have our own radio station and yeah, basically, you know, become Steve Jobs or something.
Yeah, and in terms of the world domination then, and we'll just jump forward a little bit, we'll come back to earlier maybe, but you had that huge success then kind of in the 90s. And how was it then when the dream came true? Like, how would you say you got on in subverting the music business and subverting pop music?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I've thought about that, because I think that, and then that's one thing that I kind of skirt around a little bit in the book, is this idea that ideas that you have when you're really young, they tend to go into your mind, and maybe it's because your mind is forming or whatever, and they really stick there, and you're kind of not aware of them because they've been there for so long. So I think this idea that I saw in some ways pop success as some kind of Trojan horse where you could kind of sneak in some kind of subversion or whatever. I think it stuck with me, and I always felt that if it ever happened, it wasn't about how many chateaus I could buy in France and how many sports cars I could have. It was more about what you could do to kind of shake things up and make it, you know, try and open the door for other people in some way. So when I saw that written down in an exercise book from, you know, written by my 15-year-old self, I was touched by it. I thought that, you know, it's kind of like a noble ambition in some way, and maybe I did try and put it into practice, not entirely successfully, but you know, we've all got to have a go, haven't we?
Absolutely. And then, like, when you read it, you think of maybe you accidentally kind of headlining Glastonbury in 1995. That must have felt really like the Trojan horse was completely in the door at that point, did it?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was so much about that actual thing is unbelievable. I mean, as you say, the circumstances of, you know, John Squire of the Stone Roses, who was supposed to be headlining on that Saturday night, he had this accident. Common People had been in the charts. I only found this out when I looked at the chronology recently. It was like 3 weeks since it had gone in the charts. So it was really current, really recent. So talk about a meteoric rise to success.
Yes.
Especially when you think we'd already existed for 10 years. So we'd been on this kind of, you know, flatlining thing for years. And then suddenly, da-da. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think I'll ever live through a period like that in my life. And that performance at Glastonbury and going onto that stage and hearing people sing that song will always be one of the most, you know, amazing moments of my life.
Yeah. I sense, though, you didn't enjoy that level of fame on an ongoing basis, did you? You weren't cut out for it, were you?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of factors for that, and maybe one of them was this fact that it came quite late. You know, I was, I think it was 33 when all that happened, and I had a life. Maybe I didn't realise that I did have a life, but I had got a life, and then it kind of really disrupted that. And maybe also having this thing where it had been a kind of go-to fantasy for me for so much of my life. It's pretty well established that fantasies very seldom live up to your expectations.
So I get from the book that the big turning point for you then, and you've always acknowledged this, I think, is that you fell from a window ledge in ridiculous circumstances, but it kind of changed everything for you. Will you tell us about how it happened first?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is probably a well-worn story for people who know anything about me, but yeah, I was just trying to impress a girl that I really liked, and, you know, I'd gone back to her place and it was gone a bit quiet, and you know, those kind of awkward moments when you wonder what's going to happen next. And I just thought, oh, maybe if I could impress her, that would lighten the atmosphere. But It just was doomed to failure because I'd seen this stunt done by someone a week or so before, and she lived in a modern flat and the windows were all wrong. You can read this all in the book anyway. The cut to the chase, I attempt to do this thing of going out of one window and then coming back in through another window. I attempt to do it by hanging from the window ledge and swinging across to the next window ledge. And as soon as I'm hanging from the window ledge, I think, you know what? I'm not quite as strong. Upper body strength isn't really what I thought it was. But then I realise it's so crap that I can't let... I certainly can't swing across to the other ledge, but I can't... I also can't hoist myself back into the room. She can't help me because it's a weird angle. There's nobody else in the flat. So I just have to say, okay, I'm going to count to three and let go of this window ledge. Let's fast forward a bit. I end up in hospital. And obviously I'm lucky to be alive and all that kind of thing because it was like three stories up. But I've always credited that with as being something that changed my outlook because going back to, you know, what we were saying about finding something to write about, I kind of found something to write about it. And, you know, to stretch the metaphor, I suppose, I fell to earth with a bump. And this bump kind of shook me up and in a way woke me up. And made me realise that I was having all this thing of thinking, what am I going to write about? And it was there on the ground all around me and I'd been overlooking it, looking into the distance. So from that moment on, I decided I was going to write about real life, the everyday things that were happening around me and try and write about it in as much detail as I could. And if I could do that, I was convinced that it would bear fruit. And, you know, luckily for me, it did.
Yeah, because I think, and it's there in the title, Good Pop, Bad Pop, that as much as you would kind of seem to come from a post-punk, new wavy, indie kind of place, actually for you it's all about pop, isn't it?
Yeah, I was brought up on it. I think, pop radio was what would be playing when my mum was brushing my hair, you know, getting ready to school. It's funny, you know, I'm talking to you from London in what is now called Wogan House. And it was always Terry Wogan who was on the radio at that time. And as I write in the book, from hearing his voice as he, you know, introduced records and talked in between them, I had this really, really vivid impression of him being like this kind of blonde-haired guy with a cream Aran jumper on. And obviously... Then when I saw him in, you know, when he was on telly, when he was presenting Blankety Blank, I said, no, that can't be Wogan. That's not the Wogan that I've invented for myself. But that's the thing, you know, I think pop was a really nice dream for everyone. We all kind of made our own worlds out of it. That's what I liked about it. I liked the fact that it was open and... it was anybody could join in, you know. You just watch Top of the Pops. You'd be waiting for maybe you're waiting for David Bowie to come on, but you're going to see Rene and Renato as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like a thing. It was like a thing that we could all join in with.
Yeah. So as people will be getting, the book is kind of slightly like a roadmap to creativity, or in some way attempting to explain creativity. But you tell, it's kind of a very funny story, I guess, without him meaning it to be, about meeting Leonard Cohen, and you were trying to get Leonard Cohen to explain creativity. And like he puts it so beautifully as he shoots you down.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. I mean, that was one thing that I thought, I think a lot of creative people are kind of quite superstitious about discussing their creativity. I think they think if they analyse it too much, it'll chase the muse away or whatever. And I certainly found that with Leonard Cohen. I basically very much in awe of him. You know, I've been listening to his music for so long and I've got so much from it. And so to be interviewing him was a big moment for me. And I suppose I did in some ways want to get some tips or hints or whatever. But, I asked him about the lyrics to a song. We were doing a playback of an album of his called Old Ideas, which I think was like the third one before he passed away or whatever. And he kind of looked at me and then he said, we shouldn't discuss these things. We shouldn't discuss these sacred mechanics. Somebody will throw a spanner in the works and we'll never write a song again, either of us. And, I mean, I was flattered that he included me in in that thing of creativity. But, yeah, I think that's the thing, you know. And I don't think nobody can explain creativity, because every single person's path to creativity is different. You have to find that path. It's not paved. It's something that you have to kind of get your secateurs out and chop yourself a little way through, maybe even a machete.
And so without getting into the mundanities of deconstructing songs with you, but this old chestnut keeps going on and people will want to know. So obviously, common people, the word was for years that the woman in the song who came from Greece and went to St. Martin's College was a woman called Danae Stratou, the wife of ex-Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis. Not her, apparently.
No, I've had to explain this a few times, because the thing is, this was even printed in a paper, which if they'd only consulted me first, I could have put them out of their misery. But I can see where the thing came from, because the woman you mentioned, whose name I have difficulty pronouncing, did go to St. Martin's around the time that I was there and did study sculpture. But the thing is, what happened at St. Martin's at the time, when I was there at least, was in the second term of your first year, you would do something called crossover, which was that you would try a different discipline. So I was studying film and video, but for the first 2 weeks of term two, I studied sculpture. And the woman who I met, who ended up inspiring the song, was obviously doing the same thing. Now, I don't know what her major subject was, but it certainly wasn't sculpture. She also was on this crossover thing. But as I've said, that doesn't scan as well. It's like she was trying out sculpture for just 2 weeks in the first week of the third term, and the thirst for knowledge. You know, that just does not scan as well. So I took a bit of poetic license.
Okay. Do you still hope to find her? Or do you care?
You know what? Somebody's shown me a picture. The thing is, we played a concert at St. Martin's just before the old site closed. It's now got a new home. The college is now behind St. Pancras railway station, whereas it used to be on Charing Cross Road. And we, Pulp, played a show there on the kind of day before it shut. And I'm sure somebody came up to me after that show, showed me a picture on a mobile phone and said, "Is that the woman?" And I went, "Yeah, it is." And then I've forgotten who it was who showed it me. So,
okay, so if that person is living in Ireland, they might want to get in touch with you and clarify that again. And it'd be good to have that boxed away, wouldn't it? I think you could move on then, and we could stop.
Not for me,
talking about it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I've wondered. I mean, I hope she's not offended by it.
Do you know what, though, Jarvis?
What?
It could be like becoming famous and playing Glastonbury, and it could be like Terry Wogan, and it could be a disappointment. So maybe these sacred mechanics are best left alone, aren't they?
I think you're right, Brendan.
By the way, you kind of avoided a lot of the Thatcher era by kind of sleeping through it and I suppose disco dancing at night and that. How are you finding the Johnson era in the UK? Are you getting a lot of sleep?
No, not as much, because we've got a dog that has to go out for, a constitutional at 7:30 every morning. So I'm not managing to sleep through this one. oh, God, what can I say about him? Whatever I've got to say about him, you wouldn't be able to broadcast, on over the airwaves.
Yeah. Okay. Jarvis Cocker, author of Good Pop, Bad Pop, which is published by Jonathan Cape. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Cheers, Brennan. And thank you for helping me with my hand sanitizer problem. I think
Jarvis,
I think I've turned a corner.
Yeah, you moved on from Pulp. There was life after it. You've moved on from lots of stuff. You've been a mover on all your life. You can get past this, Jarvis. I know you
Thank you. It's good to know you believe in me.
I do.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.